Welcome to The Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. As two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, Ben and Tim seek out people leading lives less ordinary and talk with them about how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further. Like intellectual bowerbirds, we aim to collect shiny little objects of knowledge that we think can help build better humans.
G'day everybody and welcome to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. My name is Ben Pronk.
And my name is Tim Curtis.
And this week, Tim, we are joined by Major General Justin Frederick, open brackets, Jake Elwood, DSC, AM, CSC.
Yep. First career in the military. He and I were young lieutenants together, actually. He was a couple of years ahead of me and actually always impressed as a leader with considerable maturity compared to my 22-year-old self.
That bar was low.
That's true. But Jake spent 30 years in the Australian Army serving in Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan and Timor-Leste. He led at all levels, and including at the very highest levels, as divisional commander and deputy chief of the Army. In his tenure in uniform, he was also the national coordinator for the Australian Defence Force's response to the Black Summer bushfires in 2019-20.
And you missed one of the most important roles he had, which was an instructor at the Royal Military College, Duntroon, where he oversaw the formative years of yours truly. But in all seriousness and not just pandering to our guest, Jake was renowned as a really good instructor, a good role model, good one of these firm, fair, friendly type characters that I think inspired a lot of people to pursue a career in infantry.
Continuing his life of service, he is now the CEO for the Queensland Reconstruction Authority, QRA, and they look after disaster recovery, reconstruction and resilience. And interestingly, have an active program of about $6 billion in projects.
That's the Unforgiving 60 budget.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But we're also going to talk to Jake, obviously, about those two amazing careers. And clearly, we're not going to be able to cover everything in depth because he has just had that much of a life less ordinary, both in and out of uniform. But we're also going to talk about that theme of resilience, both in terms of organisations and state level, including a few reflections on the world as it is and some of the challenges we're facing from a geopolitical sense, and then narrowing down a bit into some of the challenges at a regional and local sense, particularly in natural disaster-prone areas such as Queensland, which he oversees.
So 30 years in uniform and continuing service in Queensland. I was listening to a podcast. Dr. Andrew Huberman interviewed this guy, Coleman Ruiz, who's a US Navy SEAL, and he talks about the magnitude of walking into a unit like US Navy SEALs, but not like magnitude as in, isn't there a lot of buildings, isn't there a lot of people, but this sense of service, the importance of what you're doing is far bigger than anything you individually can ever be. And also what you sacrifice in order to provide that service. And Jake's an awesome pin-up guy for that, that sense of service, doing things that are bigger than him.
Yeah, and it really comes out in this chat that, you know, there is very little I statements, a lot of we, and you know, the sort of, even when we ask him about reflections on things that he's got out of it, it's always about helping others, which he's continuing to do. But we do manage to drill down into something that he does for himself, which is running, one of my favourite topics. We'll talk about his own personal practice, what it means for him at an individual level, both physically and mentally, but also keeping that theme of doing stuff for others, what he's done to spearhead the development of Run Army, which is a pretty amazing event that, as we record this, is about 1 week away in Brisbane.
Enough from you. Let's hear from Jake. Let's get on with the show.
You won't be able to go to the pub because the pub is shut. That doesn't mean you can have all your mates round to home and get on the beers.
She's gonna be back on the can.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving Podcast.
The Unforgiving Podcast, all right.
We Googled the Unrelenting 60 at one stage. Unforgiving 60 Podcast. I'm Ben Pronk, joined by...
Tim Curtis.
And we are delighted today to be joined by Jake Elwood. Jake, how are you?
Really good and great to be here and great to see you both, Ben and Tim.
Now, first up, we've got to get some nomenclature sorted. Jake Elwood, this has got to be a Blues Brothers reference, given you're Kristen Justin.
Yeah, so as is always, when you join the military, you're given a nickname, and with Elwood, it was always going to be Jake because of the Blues Brothers. And in fact, when I graduated, I remember as you stand, you go up, they call your name, and you go up on the stage to get your commissioning certificate. And they called out Justin Elwood, and I just remember all my mates going, "Who the hell's that?" And then I saw it was me. It was at one stage I thought I got a posting with the Brits to Germany, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to see what life would be like using my actual Christian name. So I introduced myself as Justin. And they said, but we've been told your name was Jake. Yeah. I said, well, Jake it is.
You see a lot of people as they go through life into more senior appointments, military and otherwise, they no longer are a Danny, they become a Daniel.
Yes, or a James. No, it used to be a Jim.
Yeah, I'm not James. Jim, don't call me James. but you couldn't shake the Jake.
Couldn't shake it. No, and I was good with that. It could have been worse anyhow. It was a great movie.
Yeah, yes, no, it absolutely. Is. It is. Yeah. And it also goes to reinforce the fact that you can't invent your own nicknames. I've had mates who have tried to, like you said, on a posting or a new life change. You know, everyone calls me Cowboy or everyone calls me Striker or something, and it just doesn't catch. You can't invent your own nickname.
Well, my footy nickname is Twitter. Don't even ask. It's a long and involved story here, and it actually does involve the social media platform, but everyone in the footy club, 150 guys, call me Twitter. They wouldn't even know my real name.
And we just call you Twit.
Yeah, exactly. But well, Jake, that's the shorthand on the field. It sounds quite odd.
I guess that military christening as Jake's probably a good place to start. It'd be awesome if you could tell us a bit about your sort of military service and sort of what led up to where you are today.
Sure. So many people wouldn't even know, but in 87, when I was still at school, I joined the Army Reserves as a private, and then went across to what was two company, one commando regiment, in my last year of school. And then I sort of joined the full-time force, went to Duntroon in 1989, and went to Infantry Corps, and which is in fact where I first met Tim in our old battalion, the 2nd 4th Battalion, up in Townsville, which doesn't exist now. So you know you're getting old when your units don't exist on the organisation anymore.
And so just looking back on that, you're sort of peers at 2RAR. Tim tops out at Major. You top out at Major General.
Should we be one word different?
It's kind of the same.
It shows how messed up the army is.
Actually, I saw a meme the other day that said something about the most realistic part about Top Gun is that the douchebag lieutenant ends up as an admiral, referring to Iceman.
That's true.
I'm not drawing parallels between you as a lieutenant, Jake. But anyway,
so why did you bring that up? It's definitely a parallel.
Yeah, I didn't mean it like that. Maybe we'll edit that bit out.
You can't edit the truth, mate.
Anyway, sorry, glossing over my bloody unkind reference there. 2RAR as a platoon commander?
Yes, and then mortars as well. And from there, I did a number of different jobs. Went to Duntroon as an instructor, which was fantastic. I did 2 years on exchange with the British Army in Germany, with the Irish Guards, where we deployed to Kosovo during that initial intervention in the aftermath of the ethnic cleansing there in 1999, and then came back to Australia and took up a company command in Timor in 2000. And then again, a range of jobs, came back to what was the 5th Battalion in 2007, a command of a battle group in southern Iraq. And then we deployed again in 2008 to Timor for a second stint there during second intervention, and then again a range of jobs, and then deployed for a year to Afghanistan as the chief of joint operations, so a US billet running current operations across the theater. And then, was commander, 1st Division was my sort of last job in the Army after having been deputy chief. And there I was coordinated the Australian Defence Force's response to the Black Summer fires in 2019-2020, and then was state recovery coordinator here for the floods in 2022, which at the end of that was when I retired from the full-time military, and that was about it. 33 years.
There is literally a podcast episode in pretty much every single one of those postings that you've mentioned. And from my own personal perspective, not least of which was your time as an instructor in RMC. You were there at the same time
I was a cadet. I'm sorry for everything I did, mate.
I mean,
it's interesting you didn't mention Ben at RMC. reasonably forgettable, clearly.
I was pretty grey at RMC. I think I peaked at ADFA, and then my military career was all downhill from there. I spent a bit of time on the drill square at RMC. Certainly, you know, those are influential positions, and they do, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but shape the next generation. But what I was going to say, it is, given that wide variety of experiences and the command at all sorts of different levels, different challenges, both domestically, internationally, that you've faced, can you hit some of the highlights, you know, in terms of what are those kind of things that you look back on the amazing memories, and in particular, you know, the specific Army stuff that you'd only get in uniform?
Well, I think, you know, as always, you know, watching our soldiers out improvising and doing their thing, and, you know, showing humour in the worst of times and the trying times, to me that was always the most special thing, and to ask things of them that were unreasonable, and to have them say, "Yep, I'm in. I'll do it. I'm boots in, all in." And so I think for me that was always a thing. It was always about working as a team, and there's something that special feeling when you're part of a group that, and you would know that, you would both know this, when you're part of a group that has this really tough job ahead, and to sort of do it together as a team, for better or for worse, to me that was always the most special thing.
Something about that idea of shared hardship, and we look at that a lot with the resilience side of things, that, you know, there's maybe sometimes a perspective that we want to make our life easier and remove stress and that sort of thing, but that process of overcoming something difficult at an individual level, but particularly if you do it as part of a team, it does create something quite unique that maybe is absent in a lot of fields of endeavour in contemporary life.
I agree. I will never forget, in Iraq, we had had one of our corporals had been had shrapnel from a mortar round when he was out on patrol, and understandably, when he got back, he didn't want to go back out. He was quite traumatized by it. I was going to send him home, and his soldiers came up to me and said, "Boss, we've got to keep him. He's great. Just let us work with him and we'll get him back out leading us." And I'm like, "So let me get this right. You're going to lead the leader out?" And they said, yeah. And I'm like, "I don't know how this is going to end, but okay, we'll give it a crack." And sure enough, they led him out and he then became their leader again. And so this, you know, again, this shared experience, this expecting unreasonable things from very reasonable people, and they do it. Yeah.
That's incredible.
You wrote in The Cove, actually, a wonderful article on frontline tactical leadership that's completely transferable, whether you're in camouflage uniform, different types of uniform, or in the civilian walk of life, where you say that there are three key aspects of leadership at that tactical level. The first is competence, probably unsurprisingly, and we love the Martin Broadwell competence model devised in 1968. The second is communications, and we talk extensively about that. But the third one's character. And you go on to say, Jake, that there are two components to character. The first is to be resilient, and the second is ethics. Your view on character.
Yeah, character is, at the end of the day, what it's all about. I've had a couple of people come to, they've disputed my view, for example, that ethics itself should be innate. Like, my view is, if your compass is a bit off, it's off. Mm-hmm. Now your compass can come off, but I think if you're that individual where the compass is already off before you begin, I think you've got a problem. I think you can help. You can certainly teach ethics as well, but I feel like there's got to be something innate in people who are vested with doing our nation's bidding, that they should, by their very nature, have a strong compass. I think you need to be driven for the right purposes. I think leaders should see themselves as servants, not the served. There should be humility. So I think there are things in your character that are super important. And whether you're a leader or whether you're led in the profession of arms, for example, I feel like it is vitally important. And resilience too. I think, and we were chatting before, but I think, you guys talking about resilience and providing people with that, with tools to use, really important, because life's going to throw hits at you. It doesn't matter if you're in the military or if you're in the emergency services, or if you're just just life gives you hits. And so giving people tools to help them become the most resilient self they can be is it's a gift, I think.
We certainly want to come back to resilience, but I do want to hit on the ethics comments you've made before we leave that, because I think this is really important. And I'd probably go even further to expand on your comments, that I certainly believe you need to have some innate level, like you said, that compass as you go. But I think from a leadership perspective, it's also critical to recognise that this isn't a passive practice, that we can't just rely on the fact that we're good people to avoid bad practices coming in, even up to and including really horrendous stuff. And clearly, the unit that Tim and I both served in, the SAS regiment, a lot of investigations and ongoing allegations into war crimes. This, to me, is really reiterated. I don't think these are fundamentally evil people that have done these sorts of things, but I do think that there has been an environment and a culture where it hasn't been actively reinforced and actively reminded at all levels about these sort of ethical principles. And I think that has contributed to almost that frog in boiling water, that normalisation of deviance that has crept in these very abnormal circumstances. And so I think you're right. I think we can't rely on a rules-based, we're just following the ROE, we're doing whatever. We need to have that principles-based ethical underpinning, but we need to actively reinforce it. We can't just rely on this idea that we're good people, so we won't do bad things.
Yeah, look, I agree, and I've spoken on ethics at a couple of forums, and if you look back and read the account of even things like My Lie, you can see the compass shift. And I think for particularly for leaders in all walks of life, if your people don't see you as ethical and as trustworthy, and you can't be trustworthy if you're not ethical, things already start to come off a bit askew. But I think as well, for me, you've got to you've got to try and be that ethical arbiter. You've got to be the, you know, you should always try to be the voice of reason. And even if something is, you know, by the letter of the law legal, it doesn't make it, it legal doesn't equal ethical. You know, so it's really making those good moral judgments. And I, you know, my view is the most important test you'll face is the mirror test at the end of it all. Are you comfortable with what you did in the face of challenges?
Well, your neat little model on this, Ben, is, you know, there's sort of two components to ethics. The first is hypocrisy, which is reasonably easy to understand. You know, I say something, but I do something completely different.
And at an organisational level as well, we're espousing these values, but maybe we're not living them. But
let's come back to that, yeah, because we're talking about frontline tactical leadership in this definition of character. And on the compass, can the compass be nudged by complete misalignment of values and purpose? But hold that thought for a second. And the second part, outside of hypocrisy, is that accepted deviance from what is acceptable. And maybe two-part question, Jake. The first one is, if, again, regardless of organisation, whoever your competitor is, and there's probably no more profound competitor than in the battlefield, if they fight by a different rule set, does that somehow give you reason to acceptably deviate from what is normal? That is, from what is morally or ethically correct.
So I guess where I sit on that is, if you've got an adversary, the chances are they are pushing things that are not in alignment with what you want. And so why would you become the same as them? Because what's your value add? In this battle, what are you fighting for? And in my view, the thing that makes us different is that we try to do things well. Now, do we always do it well? Do things always turn out well? No. I mean, in conflict, it's confusing and it's messy and it's instant and it's lethal. But at the end of it, we must differentiate ourselves from the people we are fighting or might be fighting, because that's us. That's what we're about.
I like that. Confusing, messy and lethal. It actually leads you to the conclusion that there's no simple answer, isn't there? And I put myself in a position that if I had to protect or defend my family, their life, what would I do? And maybe, this deviance on the issue of ethics that we've been seeing, not just in the Australian military, but other militaries, relates to just the primitive part of staying alive. And if you had to stay alive, what would you do in order to keep yourself, or those who it's your duty to protect, your teammates and others, what would you do to keep them alive?
I reckon there's some really interesting philosophical questions, you know, that idea of to fight the monster, you can't become the monster. And I think the interesting intersection is that point, as Tim said, where it is that existential, you know, and you look, there are places right now that are kind of living this out, you know, sort of Israel, Ukraine being good examples where, it's a real life, I guess, example of these exact ethical considerations we're talking about. And your word messy and complex, these aren't simple questions to answer. And actually, I've just got to do a quick correction. That's not my model on ethics. That's Professor Simon Longstaff, who is a colleague at University of New South Wales, who's far greater.
I've only seen it on your PowerPoint slide.
I do a lot of heavy plagiarism, and I try to attribute, but obviously I don't well. But no, that is Simon is an absolute world thinker on this, and I think those are a good. That idea of the unthinking custom and practice, that normalisation of deviance, but that hypocrisy between what we espouse and what we actually do, those are some really interesting tests of, are we acting ethically?
Well, we've got to give Jake a right of reply in a sec. That's the guest. Jake, are you still there?
I'm still here.
But, you know, I like the compass analogy that, you know, some sort of weird magnetic field could deviate the direction in which your moral compass or your ethical compass is pointing. Your thoughts on how purpose misalignment could change that? I mean, we're talking about frontline tactical leadership, those three components of competence, communications, and character. Could the character part be moved by an organization that's communicating a purpose that at frontline leadership level you just don't believe in?
Yeah, no, look, I guess that's what a leader is, right? So, you talk about the difference. What's a manager? What's a leader? A manager directs tasks and, you know, sends coordinating instructions and tells you what your purpose is and what the outcome must be. But a leader is there to inspire and to, most importantly, to influence. And to me, that's actually the hard bit. The management is in many ways quite simple. You can send someone a text or an email or an order, do this, do that. But to get individuals to want to do it and to get them to understand the deep purpose and to inspire them to really want to get at it, I think that's the hard bit of leadership. That's the tough bit.
To wrap up the sort of military career, you served at an amazing array of levels and different roles. You've obviously seen a number of generations of Australian soldiers coming through. You know, this intersection with resilience, we hear, and I'll give you my opinions on this in a second, but we hear these ideas, this younger generation's not resilient, or, you know, they're not like we used to be or whatever. Have you got perspectives on that? Initially through a military lens or in general, you know, are we seeing changes fundamentally in the character of humans, or is this just a kind of nature thing that we're seeing play out in terms of different sort of characteristics for different generations?
Yeah, I actually get quite upset when I hear some older veterans say that our soldiers of today are not what they were and not as tough and strong. The one moment that sticks out in my mind, during bushfire assist, we had a young soldier who was chainsawing trees to clear the roads, and one of the trees fell, and it meant that the chainsaw went down across her foot, and it cut down to the bone through all the tendons. And I visited her in hospital. And I asked her how she's doing. Now, if that had been me, I would have been sitting there crying and complaining about the pain that I was in. She said to me, "My only regret is I couldn't help more people." That was it. She was concerned more about others than herself. And so we have a wonderful generation, and it's really up to this new generation of leader to help them be the best versions of themselves. And the best version of them, I got to tell you, is pretty amazing.
As you look through the commander's telescope into battle spaces of the future, Jake, how will they change the demands on humans? How do we better prepare soldiers, sailors, airmen,
aviators,
air people? In the US context, Marines, how do we prepare them better for future battle spaces?
I think it's tough because now everything's 24/7. But mind you, we're evolving as well. We have our phones and we get texts. You know, I get work texts quite late at night time, and when I was in the military, it became a 24/7. Back, you know, when I first joined, I don't wasn't a thing, right?
It was easy to look back through those rose-coloured glasses where there was one computer in the whole company and
with one telephone down in the O
Club.
And the
computer had sort of liquid paper smudges on the screen.
Yep.
But, so I think, and then... the reach is further. I think everything's probably quicker and bigger, and it's helping people deal with that sort of that very fast paced and relentless environment that they're living in, but also in an environment where people have changed and societal expectations have changed as well. But then at the core of us, we're still, you know, each of us have our weaknesses. And so help, because at the end of it, it's you know, it is internally how an individual gets through things. I think that some things stay the same, and helping people get through tough times, I think there are probably some enduring pieces to support.
And you might have taught me this at RMC. I'm going to quote Clausewitz, but that idea of the enduring sort of nature, that fundamentally conflict isn't going to change. It's this clash of worlds and ideology, as you said, I think beautifully, this idea of, well, if we are in a military adversary, it's probably because there is an ethical difference in terms of the two forces. That's going to remain constant, but the character of it, so the different ways that it plays out, the different importance of maybe a tactical error on the battlefield, if that's captured and streamed instantly live, and we start getting that kind of, I guess, visibility down at the very grassroots level, that is going to change the character of conflict and demand more, I think, of our individual soldiers, and particularly in that ethical space. So I think it does tie together a couple of those threads we were speaking about.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. But we've got the people to do it. Like I said, yeah. We've got an amazing new generation of soldiers, sailors, and aviators who are going to get at it. So I never worry about that. But we are blessed. We shouldn't take it for granted as well that we have so many who want to continue to serve their nation.
Come on.
Now, speaking of serving, you alluded to some of the disaster relief work you'd done in uniform towards the end of your career particularly. You've now transitioned into that space full time. Can you tell us about your role within QRA and I guess that continuation of service, albeit in a slightly different fashion?
Yeah, so Queensland Reconstruction Authority is an amazing organisation, born in 2011 after Tropical Cyclone Yasi and the floods in southern Queensland. And since that time, it has taken on responsibility initially for the reconstruction of much of Queensland, of all those areas that have been so badly damaged, now both reconstruction and also resilience building. And that, to me, has been a really good shift. So, you know, for example, we might build back roads differently, or bridges, or that sort of thing. We have different programs. It's not also just about infrastructure. There's things like, mental health support for impacted communities, environment, built infrastructure, economy. So if you look at the issues that we've had over the terrible disasters over Christmas, the impact on tourism, so packages that might support different businesses. So it's a wide-ranging scope. Work very closely with the amazing departments within the Queensland government and all the 77 councils. So it's a great job, because I got to work with QRA when I was a state recovery coordinator for the Southern Queensland floods, and I must say I fell in love with it. I thought it was, what a great endeavour, an organisation that is just out there to do good, and good they do lots of. So I feel very fortunate to now have a whole new piece of I guess a whole new purpose to support community.
In an interdepartmental sense, Jake, what are we doing well in the state of Queensland as it relates to disaster recovery, reconstruction, and resilience?
Look, a whole host of areas. Since 2011, we've had about, there's been 117 events, significant events impacting the state. And I think, you know, because it is the most disaster impacted state, it hasn't squandered that experience. It's been hard won, but because, so, which has meant that we have, you know, local resilience strategies, regional resilience strategies, and that we don't just look at it through a single lens. It is looked across that whole scope of and really understanding that at the end of it all, recovery revolves around individuals and communities. It doesn't revolve around a road. A road is there to support the community. It's there to support people. And so I think it's done well, but it's challenging. I mean, the last events over Christmas were just, you know, bad enough that we had Jasper and the flooding that followed in the north, but then we had those terrible storms in southeast Queensland and Tropical Cyclone Kirrily and the flooding that we're still seeing and the communities are still feeling. It just, you know, really large impacts, and every community impacted differently. But I think that's the other neat part here is that we look at communities, each community differently. If it's rural, if it's remote, if it's town or a city, solutions are tailor made. So I think it's done well, but it's tough. You know, it's just tough work that you feel like you want to do more. There's of course only so much, but we have resilient communities too, and I think that's a great thing. Is because we are so, I guess we've had so many disasters. The communities are, by and large, very resilient.
Well, could we talk about that? You've been travelling extensively to disaster ravaged areas. What are communities at that local level? What are they doing well in order to ensure resilience?
So, look, it happens in many ways. Firstly, you'll find the local leaders are out making sure that those who need support are getting the support that they require. It can even come in the form of in a street, they'll have a barbecue. But there will be times when, for example, there's flooding, people say, bring all your stuff up to our house, or, you know, someone, like we saw over Christmas, people saving other people with tinnies. So and this is very important. Some people might go, well, you know, why is the local council or the state or the federal government not doing everything? Our true strength is actually at community level. I mean, we've got to help one another first and foremost. And those that can't help one another, then you have that next layer that comes into support and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, I don't see it as a failure. I see it as a beautiful thing. And frankly, what Australians are all about is helping one another. So but, you know, the thing I like is it just happens, and when there's an event, you know, no warning, and then suddenly, you know, Joe or Jill up the street who happen to have this tinny rolls out the tin and is sort of sailing down the street helping people, and I think that's a great thing. And as well, in the aftermath during the recovery, people are, you know, giving others meals or offering accommodation. It's just it's pretty inspiring to see.
I love that on a couple of levels. One, as a metaphor for resilience writ large. I mean, we preface almost everything we talk about in the resilience space with this idea that it's got to come driven from you individually. We quote that Marcus Aurelius, wonderful Marcus Aurelius, saying you need to get active in your own rescue, you know, and not just physically, you know, doing something for yourself, but that mentality that fundamentally it's got to start with you. If you're sitting there as a victim and expecting QRA to come swooping in black helicopters or however you get into a disaster ravaged area and do all the work, then that's a recipe for failure. And at all levels of resilience, you need to be driving that yourself and looking after your friends. But I also love that idea, and there's some beautiful sort of discussion. I really like that philosophical concept of whether humans are fundamentally Hobbesian, you know, life is nasty, brutish, short, we'll kill each other given the first chance, or we're more sort of fundamentally sort of the Rousseau model, the gentle sort of kind and sort of caring individual. And I think, you know, you get even things like Hurricane Katrina. Remember, there was all that sort of reporting about how it just turned to anarchy. And then when people started to unpack that, there was actually far more benevolence and selflessness in that environment. And I take it, Jake, that's what you're seeing in the aftermath of disasters. You're seeing far less of the nasty side of humanity and far more of the beautiful side.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and the other layer on top of that is seeing our amazing emergency management services, the police and the fireys, mm-hmm. and the SES, and the ambulance service, all leaning in to help communities. They to me are truly heroes. I take my hat off to them when you see them out there doing what it is that they do. But, you know, and the other things we sort of try to do is we have campaigns, if it's flooded, forget it, get ready Queensland, all these things, again, to help, I guess, equip people with that idea of what could I do to help myself, and what could I do to help my friends and neighbours. But, yeah, look, to me, people not helping others is absolutely the exception, not the rule. The rule is, like, you just see so many out there wanting to help. It's just, and it requires no one to ask them. Yeah. They just...
There's something incredibly inspiring about people who will run towards the metaphorical sound of the guns, and even just the tragic events in Bondi over the last, what was that, 24, 36 hours as we record this. And that incredible footage, obviously the police officer who resolved the incident ultimately, but, you know, people with bollards sort of at the top of escalators and self-organised people who aren't just going to look the other way, aren't just looking after themselves, but will run towards the sound of the guns when other people need it. I'm getting goosebumps just sort of thinking about it. That is real humanity.
Absolutely. Yeah, we live in a blessed country and very much because we have wonderful people and it's a great society. We really are lucky.
You've had some phenomenally high-pressure jobs, you know, Deputy Chief of the Army, Divisional Commander, you know, leading through disasters, which could all take their toll.
Senior subby in the 2-4.
Trying to keep the more junior lieutenants just arriving in the...
Cadet
That's right. Yeah, trying to deal with horrible officer cadets at the Royal Military College. What do you do for you, Jake? What are your non-negotiables in terms of habits? What would you not trade out?
So for me, running is my thing. If I couldn't do, I think sleep's pretty important. I mean, you do need to be able to sleep. As long as I can get 4 hours, I know I'm good. And if I can get a sort of a hamburger meal out of McDonald's, that's my nutrition. I'm good with that. But
by the way, this is not Resilience Shield endorsed sleep or diet.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. But for me, running has always been my church. It started, you know, when I was 15. My mum, who she had serious mental health issues, so she left home, and we didn't have a lot of money. It was a lot of struggle. Anyhow, I thought one day I'm just going to go running. I don't know why I decided to do that.
Almost a Forrest Gump style.
Yeah, that's right. And I got on one of those, you know, those old World War One type canvas packs, and I shoved in 2 phone books, and most people won't even know what a phone book is, but the white and the yellow pages, I shoved them in and just went sort of running. And as I did that more and more and more, I felt better and better and better. And so that became the framework. I moved away from running for a little, but then when I was a cadet at Duntroon, and I was a much worse cadet than you were, Ben. I mean, compared to me, you were awesome. I ended up contracting malaria during our adventurous training, and when I came home, I just found everything was just physically a bit tough, and I thought, well, running worked when I was 15. Why don't I just try running again? And so I did, and then I never stopped. And so that's my thing. It's my church. It's what I do.
And I'm keen. Well, I'm about to kick Tim out because he gets bored when I start talking about running. But
if it doesn't involve a barbell at the moment, I'm not interested.
But this is about to happen. So yeah. But can I just expand? I love that saying, running as a church. This idea of something bigger, something meditative, something sort of almost spiritual. Can you sort of expand on that in terms of what it means as part of your routine and what you get out of it from the mental side? I mean, the physical side is pretty obvious for most people, but how does running help you from a mental perspective?
Well, look, I think, you know, the start of a running journey, that is every single run, because every run is like a journey. I journey from not wanting to get out of bed and not wanting to do it, so fighting myself. I love that. I hate it, but I love it. And then once I'm actually out the door while running, I get to not think too much about too much. Mm. I will think about maybe a really tricky problem that I've got, and sometimes it helps me get clarity. A lot of people meditate. I've tried. I'm hopeless. I cannot concentrate unless my two legs are moving as quickly as I can make them, which is not very quick. But so it helps me get clarity. And then at the end of it, there's this feeling of I did something I didn't feel like doing, and I really actually ended up enjoying it. And by the way, I might have solved a problem in my mind. So I guess, so for me, that's what it does. It's a great thing.
And it's really interesting to hear you saying about, you know, maybe not every single run, but running is still a struggle in many cases. Like, you know, it's not like you leap out of bed and even someone who enjoys it so much gets so much out of it. You still need to have that motivation. Do you have any, I was going to say tricks, but techniques that get you out the door to the point where you can start enjoying it?
I do. I lay out my running gear the night before every single time, and then I sometimes tell myself I'm not going to run, but I'll just put on my PT kit just because I've laid it out in the morning, so I'll put it on. And then I go, oh, I can't really take off my PT kit unless I've actually run. Mm, yeah. So it's like this mind game of forcing it. And, you know, it is funny. I mean, I don't know, Tim, it's probably the same though with the gym is you it seems like an inconvenience, and you try to talk yourself out, but you know it's just you trying to talk yourself out, so you fight it, and then so you just get in and do it, and then you're glad you've done it. But it's funny, people think because I run a lot, I must jump out of bed in the morning. Oh, I can't wait to go for that run. I reckon 99 out of 100 runs is a struggle.
Mm. Yeah.
There'll be one morning when I wake up going, oh, I can't wait to go for that run, but it's a rarity. But I've never come home from a run saying, I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah.
Never.
That's pretty cool. And clearly you've got a few runs ahead of you. You've got a few runs under your belt, but a few runs ahead of you. I understand you are training for two big marathons this year.
Yeah, so I'm going to do Gold Coast, and then I'm going to do New York. New York was always one of those runs that you got to do. I did Boston, which was wonderful, but in 2018 it had
You did that race.
The weather was very interesting. I the weather guy had said, oh, it's going to be freezing, it'll be the coldest Boston marathon ever, and it's going to be raining, and I decided I knew better, and so I just had a pair of shorts and a t-shirt and what turned out to be a non-waterproof light top. By the time we actually started running, it was, I think, 2 degrees, 60K an hour winds. By the time I started running, because you're in that race area for about an hour, I was already marginally hypothermic, you know, that because you're shivering relentlessly. By the time I finished the race, I couldn't even put on the warm weather kit that I had put into baggage. So I'm just sitting there like, just not completely confused and just shaking like a leaf, and someone then kindly offered to help me put my top on like I was a little baby. But I was very grateful.
For those
it was pretty awesome. It was an awesome experience.
That is mind-blowing, because for those who don't sort of follow running, which is probably about 99.9% of the community, 2018 is like this landmark Boston year where it was just horrendous. And I think there was Yuichi Kamauchi, the Japanese citizen runner, just did this amazing sort of hardcore from the front sort of run to win in these horrendous conditions. But yeah, if you look up the YouTube footage of it, it doesn't look like a pleasant experience. But awesome to have gone through it.
No, and I think, to be honest, while I was cursing the weather during it, just cursing it, it's at the end of it, you go, well, that was super hard, and I did it. And I didn't want to do it. I got to about 35K mark, and I was giving myself every reason why I could pull out of it. But of course, you just don't. You keep going. I ran in Lombok later, later that year, and it was 34 degrees.
The opposite.
And there was no, it was like 600 meter climb. I looked at the sort of the levels, and it looked like it was going to be a flat course, but it turned out that it was anything but
your
flat.
Scale was out.
Yeah, it was out. There was something wrong.
You're looking at a 1 to 100,000 map.
And I was actually by the end of it hoping that a car would just clip my wing so that I could go to hospital and be hydrated and not finish and at least have an excuse. But that didn't happen.
So I had to suffer.
We've got to introduce you to the world's longest marathon. We've got to get a plug in here for the world's longest marathon, the Marathon de Médoc.
So only one of us, we've all completed marathons, the three of us, but only one of us has done the Marathon de Médoc. Do you want to talk through the particular trials and tribulations of that event?
Yep. So it is a legit marathon, 42.195 kilometres through the wine fields of Bordeaux. And I haven't fact-checked this, but I think the winners are doing it in 220, so it can be legit. But there are 23 chateaus on the way serving 23 varietals of red wine. And whilst it's not compulsory, it's certainly strongly encouraged to stop at every chateau and partake in a glass.
So, yeah, different kind of hardship, I guess.
Well, I mean, competence, communications and character are definitely tested on that run.
Have you been to India? 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 Well, you better get some of it, India. Have you been to India? That shit there will blow ya.
That's funny. But before we do leave the running conversation, I do want to talk about Run Army. Can you tell us about, so as we record this, and it'll probably by the time we air this, it'll have occurred, but this is happening next week, next Sunday. Can you tell us about the event and particularly about its genesis and what it's sort of become?
Yeah, so look, back in 2020 when I was divisional commander out at Enoggera Barracks, I did notice that as I was talking to soldiers and getting to sort of getting around, and I'd even see at the gym, there were people who to me were clearly struggling. And I thought, boy, if we could just give you the gift of running, that would be quite a gift to give. And so what I did is I said, look, let's start what we called Running Change, which is a 8-week running program. Uses heart rate running as the base, Maffetone. And so we started.
So can you just expand on the title? I think I love this title because people who have served in the military who have done a group PT session under a feared PTI, tell us about Running Change as a title.
Yeah, so I couldn't resist it because our PTIs. Wonderful PDIs who used to smash us. You would be walking and then they would say running change, which meant you had to run. It sort of break into running cadence. And of course, the next thing you're praying for is walking change, but it never seemed to come soon enough.
I've never heard that. Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, Look, that would be a pretty neat title for Army, because it's running and then, but it changing the way you look at running. Because I realised we never got taught how to run. No. We got told run over there like a startled gazelle, and it was just an expectation that you knew how to run properly.
Really found, particularly as I'm getting older, is that every run you did was hard. You ran as fast as you could, or you ran at race pace. And, of course, that's a pretty – well, it works if you're an 18-year-old person with rubber elastic tendons and unbreakable sort of muscles, but not as a 48-year-old person.
No, we did have a no-pain, no-gain mentality. And, in fact – you know, as time went on, the Army moved away from a lot of running because of the injuries, but it had nothing to do with the running. It was the way we were having people run. They were running in boots. They were running with no training. They were sort of having to sprint before they could even run properly.
Yeah.
And so I think to me, we, in some ways, running was demonized, but it was only because it was done very poorly. Mm. And so, yeah, we thought with this course, heart rate method, and we had massive success. And since that time, we've had 800 do the course, which is super exciting. And I've met people who were afraid of running, petrified of the BFA track, to a point where
fitness assessment. What's that? The five kilometer, isn't it?
2.4.
No, it's in 2.4 now. Get with the time. You're showing your age, mate.
I know. But geez, they've halved the degree of difficulty. That's great. I'm getting back in.
Well, the problem is 2.4, you've got to run even quicker.
That's true. That's true. More intensity.
So I really wanted to break people's anxiety of running as well, and this seemed like a good way to do it. So, yeah, it's been a very successful course. But I thought, well, if we're going to do the course, we should have an event to celebrate graduating. Mm. And so we thought in the first year, in 2021, we had had a what looked very much like a brigade cross country, but we had visions of it becoming bigger, because I'd done the Marine Corps Marathon, yeah, and I knew about the US Army 10 miler and the Canadian Army Army Run 5K, and I thought, look, I think we should have an event that we could grow. So we started with that event, 1100, and now it's grown. It went 2400 first time in the city, and now we're sort of at around about 5,500 registrations for Brisbane, about 1,700 registrations for Townsville, and about 1,000 virtuals. And I think we'll get a lot more as the week progresses. And really, it was, and we brought in all our wonderful emergency services, yeah, so police, fires, and AMBOs, first responders, because I thought, well, let's bring them in. But it really, it's about highlighting the importance of physical health and well-being that also supports your mental health as well. So that's how it came about. We raised money for Legacy. I thought that would be a wonderful thing to give money to. And so we've raised, since 2021, $500,000 for Legacy, and we hope to continue to raise lots for them. They do great work and have been for now over 100 years supporting our families. So to me, it's a great program. We have Rob DiCostella, the great Rob DiCostella, yep, is our patron, and have from the very start. He started the Indigenous Marathon Foundation, an amazing Australian, yeah, and actually an amazing guy to talk to in terms of his story. But yeah, so we're very happy and very proud I'm proud of what the team has achieved, and I'm actually proud to see people get out and test themselves too. I think it's wonderful.
I love it.
You talked about a heart rate method, and you mentioned Maffetone, which is Phil Maffetone, mm-hmm, who has the maximum aerobic function from memory, which rather than 220 minus your age is 180 minus your age.
Mm-hmm.
I got paid out over the weekend for running like math. 180 minus my age means my heart rate doesn't get very high. But can you talk about that, the benefit of using a system like maximum aerobic function?
So you're exactly right. 180 minus age. And what it does is, so when you are, for example, in pain, your heart rate will go up. So if you're going to stick to your heart rate, it means you'll actually go slower. And over time, though, you start and some people get frustrated initially. They've got to walk, then they walk, and then run, walk, run, run, walk. But what it's doing is it's building up this foundation, and you're running at the capacity not of your mind and what you think you can do or what your ego tells you to do. You're actually running at the capacity of your actual physical, your body. Mm. And your heart isn't driven by emotion. Your heart is driven by physicality. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really good way to stay very pure. And even if you don't have a heart rate monitor, you should be able to talk a very easy conversational pace. And I've found over time, when I started, and I started because I had a health issue, I was frustrated. My ego got the better of me. I'm like, hang on, I can run faster than that. But over time, and I was doing a lot of walking, but within a few weeks, I was doing a lot more running. And now, you know, on a good day, I will get a pretty reasonable time running, keeping my heart rate at the sort of 126 to 130. Mm. So it's a very safe way to run. Yeah. But if you're running in the tropics or in the heat, you've got a better chance of staying healthy during the run because you're not running beyond what your body is saying you can do.
And by 21 it sailed the seven seas, but it never seemed that far to him.
Yeah, it's a cool system. I used it training for a half Ironman a couple of years ago now. And the cool thing, so you're not running with intensity, which means you're lessening the risk of injury. You're also not feeling miserable at the end of the run, which probably makes you more inclined to pull the runners on tomorrow. And the other cool thing is that you can pull the runners on tomorrow. You could run every single day because of the absence of intensity.
And it is amazing, I found, how fast you can get doing most of your running, what you feel is very, very slow. You know, if you can park the ego and, shit, if you've got any tips on that, I still struggle with exactly what you said, Jake, just, this is too slow, I'm a fast runner, that sort of moronic mentality. But, you know, if you're gentle on yourself for the vast majority of your running, and yeah, you do need to do some intensity stuff if you want to sort of sharpen up, but you can make amazing progress. And it's almost counterintuitive that you're running a race so much quicker than you've ever run in practice, but you can do it because you built that base.
Mm. Yeah, it's spot on. And it is completely counterintuitive. When I started doing it, I didn't believe it could possibly work. I thought that was actually my friend who's a coach. I thought it was his gentle way of saying,
slow down.
You can no longer run. it's over. You're old.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, it does work. And Tim, to your point, I think it's spot on that a lot of people, when they run hard and then they're sore and they hate it and it feels terrible and all these bad emotions are attached to running, which then brings an avoidance strategy. Whereas with running by heart rate, you finish at the end feeling like, boy, was that really a run? Or I feel like I could have done more, which makes you want to come back, and it means you can come back too. So I think it's got so many advantages, because with running, consistency is also super important. But to me, it was also, it's not just about the running. I mean, am I a running zealot? Yep, self-confess. But it's about anything that is physical, that is arduous, that takes time, that that you need to struggle with in your mind, that is therefore building both your body, but it's developing your mind and its ways of being able to cope with things that are uncomfortable. And so I think to me, even if that's swimming or cycling or, but it's got to be long and there's got to be a degree of discomfort.
I like
that medical fraternity advocating 150 minutes a week in zone two, which is 60% of your maximum heart rate. I haven't done the math on Mathetone's 180 minus age, but it's probably pretty close to zone two, 60% of your maximum heart rate, which is getting your time in for the 150 minutes a week, which the medical professionals are saying we got to do.
And one of the other great things I think about that sort of style of training is that you are itching to go fast when it's go time. And I take it, are you towing the line this Sunday, Jake, in Brisbane?
Yeah, I am. But for me, when I'd always do the 10, but that's my cheat run. That's the run I do when I'm out there enjoying it, thanking all nice. all the people along the way that are supporting us. And so I don't really...
Race it per se.
Last year they said, "What time do you get?" I'm like, "I don't know. I don't really care." I was just so happy with what I was seeing out there. It's like sort of looking at your kid.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool.
Sounds like the marathon de Medoc. You don't pay attention to the time when
it's not about the time.
No, not after 2.5 litres of red wine. Well, that wasn't happening right then, but the next day, Will Rob De Castella run?
No, so Rob does run, but we have him there to sort of G up the crowd, and then he goes around and he'll chat to people, and just sort of having someone like him to provide advice to runners is just something super special. And then look, working very closely with Rob to see where we can make good linkages with the Indigenous Marathon Foundation, because what they are doing with communities, bring running to communities, and then they take some of those who've done the program over to do the New York Marathon and other marathons overseas, changes their life. And then at the end of that, they have a "so what now" program. So they've done the marathon, and then it's all right, marathon, great. So let's talk about how you're going to harness what you've learned to help yourself and the broader community. So he is amazing in terms of his passion to help Australians who need support.
We spoke with Andrew Lee back in season 2 or 3, so the federal parliamentarian who is also, I think he's also a patron, but he's certainly heavily involved with the Indigenous Marathon Foundation. Echoed those sentiments about what a great initiative it is. And in fact, he just did, I think, a 2:59 in Canberra 2 weeks ago, the Canberra Marathon. So he's still sort of tearing it up. And in fact, I was going to say, speaking of times, we are following a couple of people in Run Army. So Kieran Perkins, who I think is defending 2 titles. I understand. So Kieran's an amazing athlete, not Kieran Perkins the swimmer. Kieran Perkins, the amazing runner, and he's just got out after an amazing military career. But he's the real deal, 2:17 marathoner, and I think he'll be pushing sort of around that low 30-minute mark for this weekend.
Yeah, so I was out running the other day, and Kieran ran by and then stopped. Literally, I think for him, it felt like stopping as he was running with me. But he said that he had he's in the fire and emergency services. So he was so happy that we had brought in the emergency services as partners in the race. So he is a force to be reckoned with. He's won it every year, like since its beginning.
Yeah.
And he's a good person, super humble.
Absolutely.
And but a very talented runner. I'd be surprised if anyone comes close to Kieran.
Yeah. And we're also following a friend of the Resilient Shield, Brendan McCurdy, who is going in the 5K. He set this as a goal for himself and has been sort of chronicling some of his training up to this event, which I think speaks to the reach of Run Army beyond just the people in uniform, either the emergency responders or military. Brendan has sort of caught the bug, I think, without putting words in his mouth, and I'm really looking forward to seeing him perform on the weekend.
That's awesome. And we want to see parents and kids and people who aren't linked with the military or emergency. We just want the community out there with those first line responders and army. And, the other day I was doing a park run and someone was wearing a Run Army shirt. And I actually made the assumption that they were in the military. And so I said, which unit do you serve in? And he said, I'm not in the military. I'm not in the emergency services. I said, well, that is awesome. You're exactly what we're after.
Yeah,
that's great. be better. So it's a good thing.
And, of course, the virtual event spreads it much further than just the Brisbane and Townsville geographic locations. I actually got my virtual 10K in yesterday morning, so I'm just waiting for the portal to open. My plan is to be the first there, and I'll take a screenshot when I'm coming first in the virtual event. Used to do that in the old CrossFit Open,
exactly,
didn't you?
Yeah, do it as early as you possibly can. Number one on the leaderboard. Then watch yourself slip down the leaderboard.
Yeah, crushing as the proper athletes start posting. but it is great. It's a fantastic initiative.
Nah, thanks. And yeah, we're very, very proud of where it's heading. And but such an amazing team behind it. People like Mark Bretter have just been super supportive in getting so much support, but Army has been all in, so it's just been great across the board to see such support, and that I think that recognition that of what benefits this sort of thing can bring for the community.
Well, we can't leave this topic or this podcast without asking a question that we often pose to our guests, and that is, what is your power song? Have you got a particular tune that sort of always gives you that extra bit of a surge in a run or a workout of some variety?
Well, I think as the former commanding officer of the 5th Battalion, I would have to say Eye of the Tiger.
Nice. The Unforgiving 60 podcast has the Unforgiving 60 playlist on Spotify, and we will add Eye of the Tiger if it's not already there.
I reckon it might already be there. Yeah, we might double check that, but that is a classic. Yeah, yeah, I like that. Yeah. And of course, the tiger being the in fact, back in the day, there was an actual tiger sponsored by 5RL, wasn't there? One of the zoos.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So they've had a few tigers, and up in Darwin, when I took over as CEO, we adopted the tiger up there at Crocodilus Park. I'm not sure what the status is at the moment, but it was, the tiger would come on to parade and sort of, I think the tiger had the best spot on parade, shade and getting fed meat while all the soldiers were out there
rolling over,
sort of sweating in the sun in Darwin. So I was always a little envious of that tiger.
I do always remember the 2-4 and then 2 RAR versus 1 RAR rivalry, and it often ended up with unspeakable things happening to 1RAR's pony, you know, getting its hair done or cropped and I think spray painted at one stage, which I think is actually pretty dangerous. But anyway, I take it that never, you didn't get a bunch of diggers thinking it'd be a good idea to spray paint 5RAR's tiger.
Go in Iraq with a tiger and see what happens.
No one was messing with that tiger. I remember a kid came up sort of near the cage and it was sort of taunting, and suddenly the tiger did something that made the kid cry. So, yeah, the tiger could hold its own.
That's good, yeah. My dad served in 161 Recce Squadron, and their mascot was, of course, a possum, which is probably not as intimidating as a tiger, but still a pretty cute little mascot.
Possums can be pretty evil.
Yeah, true. Well, listen, Jake, that's probably a really great place to wrap it up. We're really appreciative of your time. You're clearly in a really busy role, and we appreciate you making the time to have this chat and, cover a broad range of topics that I found super interesting.
Great to catch up, guys, and, really good to see you, Tim. As I said, it's been a number of years since I've seen you, and Ben, great to catch up as well. So thank you very much, both.
Thanks, Jake.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence and would love your insights and feedback. Also, if you know someone who is living a life less ordinary, let us know. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's debrief@unforgiving60.com. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search for Unforgiving 60 on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Until next time, we wish you luck in filling your unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. I said, do you know who I am?
turned around.